Well, let me begin this morning by saying I'm very aware the topic that we're thinking about together today is one which almost certainly for a large number of us here is not going to be some far removed concept with which we're just generally familiar, but rather a reality that very many of us will have felt and experienced personally. And the most recent statistics tell us that 42% of divorces, of marriages in the UK end in divorce. And if they're to be believed, then even if, by God's grace, the percentage might be lower amongst Christians, it is still very likely that many of us here will have had personal experience of painful marital breakup within our own families. Not long ago, actually, someone told me the desperately sad news that a lovely couple who'd been my youth group leaders in the church that I grew up in had recently got divorced after 20 years of marriage. And I've witnessed firsthand the deep hurt that has been caused from divorce in my own extended family amongst professing Christians. So I'm very aware that there are a whole range of feelings that a passage like this one could dredge up amongst us this morning. And there are two potential reactions to this passage in particular that I just want to try and steer us away from right up front. And they are guilt and pride. So for any here who perhaps have personally experienced divorce, I know this would be a very easy passage to read and come away from feeling an enormous weight of guilt and shame. Well, on the other hand, for those of us who haven't been divorced ourselves, but who've seen it in people close to us or in our own family, it'd be very easy to read this passage and come away with some sense of moral superiority, perhaps even a sense of self-righteous anger at the effect that it's had on us or on someone we love. And yet, actually, if we understand this passage in the context of Matthew's Gospel, the context in which it comes, we'll realise that those responses are, in fact, the exact opposite of what Matthew wants us to be feeling at this point in his Gospel. So chapter 19 actually starts a whole new section in Matthew's Gospel. It's a section we're going to be spending the next few weeks going through. And this is a section which is really all about God's grace to us. The repeated theme through these next few chapters is that none of us deserve to be accepted by God, and that every single one of us needs the mercy that is found only in recognizing Jesus as our Saviour. Now, when you think about it, I think that raises an interesting question about our passage today, doesn't it? Why does Matthew choose to start a section that is all about our need for God's grace with this discussion here about divorce? And the more that I've reflected on that question, the more I've been persuaded that actually the purpose of this passage is not primarily to reiterate what God has already clearly said in his words about the doctrine of marriage, but rather it's to use this issue to point all of us to the desperately fallen state of humanity as a whole, and to show each one of us our personal need for God's grace in Jesus. That's what I hope we're going to see this morning as we go through it together. And if that is the case, then I think it's important we get this really clear right at the start. Can you see the purpose of this passage when it's seen in its context? Well, for the Christian who's failed in this area isn't to produce guilt and shame, but great thanksgiving and joy in God's grace. And likewise, the purpose for the Christian who hasn't failed themselves in this area, but who's maybe felt and experienced the effects of divorce, well, it's not to produce pride or anger, and rather it's to produce a deep sense of humility and a spirit of love and forgiveness. The key verse of this passage we're going to see is verse 8. Jesus says, "Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because," literally, "of your hard hearts." It comes in the context of this question that the Pharisees ask about divorce in verse 3. So Jesus is en route to Jerusalem at this point. And as we've seen happen before, again, the Pharisees are out to try and get him to say something that'll land him in hot water. So the Pharisees, verse 3, some Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? What they're doing is trying to press him on what was quite a contentious issue amongst the Jews of Jesus' day over what were acceptable grounds for divorce. As the debate hung on the interpretation of a verse in Deuteronomy 24, where in the law of Moses, divorce is said to be permitted on the grounds of something indecent having been committed. And an opinion on what exactly was meant by something indecent was roughly divided into two camps. So on the one hand, there was this school of Shammai, the religious conservatives, who taught that divorce was only permissible on the grounds of sexual misconduct. And then on the other hand, there was a more liberal school called Hillel, who would permit a man to divorce his wife for something as trivial as an improperly cooked meal. So come home one day and find that the rice was a bit too soggy, or the potatoes were a little overdone, and that would be sufficient grounds for ending the marriage. Apparently one Hillelite rabbi called Akiba even permitted a man to divorce his wife if he found other women more attractive. So, you know, the wrinkles started to appear and her hair turned a little bit more grey, and Akiba said, well, it'd be fine for a man to look at his pretty young next-door neighbour and say, sorry, honey, I think I want a younger model. Well, in what follows, we're going to see very helpfully that Jesus actually has something to say both to the laid-back liberal and to the moralistic conservative. So firstly, to the laid-back liberal, verses 4 to 6, Jesus gives a clear reminder from Genesis of God's design for marriage. Look with me at verse 4. Haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. See, the attitude behind the Pharisees' question is, well, divorce, surely that's okay as long as it's done in the right way. But Jesus wants to take us a step back from that, to show us that divorce, actually for whatever reason it happens, it is always a departure from God's original intention for marriage. A pattern that God established in creation was that marriage was to be between one man and one woman, verse 4, and that it was to be a permanent union, verses 5 and 6. Now that permanence is shown by two actions, verses 5 and 6. Firstly, the leaving and cleaving of verse 5. Man leaves his father and mother and is united with his wife. So that the image there at the point of marriage is of this permanent change in a man's primary sphere of relationship. This transfer from the primary family relationship as being with his parents to now being with his wife, to whom he's united. In other words, this is a one-time only, lifelong switch. And secondly, marriage is to be cemented as a permanent union by the physical act of sex. So however much our culture may want to tell us that sex can be casual and frivolous, well, the truth, says Jesus, as he affirms Genesis 2, is that it's a deeply significant expression at the most intimate level of an irreversible bond that is created between a man and a woman at marriage. The two become one flesh. And notice how Jesus puts it in verse 6. They are no longer two, but one. So as the man and woman come together, Jesus says an irreversible change occurs. A union is established. And from that point on, there is a very real sense in which these are no longer just two independent individuals, but one united couple. God has joined them together, says Jesus. And so whatever reason divorce might happen between two married people, See, it's never a situation that God is just indifferent about, or that we should be unmoved by. It's always a cause for great sadness. God's design for marriage is, and always has been, for it to be a permanent union. Dick France, in his commentary on Matthew, puts it like this. Those who start from Deuteronomy 24 will have as their basic presupposition that divorce is to be expected, but the question being only how it is to be regulated. But those who start from Genesis 1 and 2 will see any separation of what God has joined together as always an evil. Circumstances may prove it to be the lesser evil, but that can never make it less than an infringement of the primary purpose of God for marriage. So let me pause briefly at that point and just say a word or two to those who are married or to those who are considering marriage. Firstly, if you aren't someone here who's married, can I urge you, in the light of Jesus' teaching here, to make every effort to work hard at your marriage and to stay married. As someone who's not married, I can't say that I have first-hand experience of all of the difficulties and temptations of marriage. What I do know is that the world all around us, it is constantly shouting at us from every angle to be impatient and self-centered and to prize our own happiness above anything and everything else in life. Now, please don't hear me at this point as saying that Christians should just put up with anything in marriage. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not speaking into situations of domestic abuse, for example. Jesus affirms in verse 19 that sadly there are situations where divorce is permissible and very sadly may be necessary. But if it is simply the case that marriage hasn't turned out to be quite as easy or as happy as you thought it might be, well, please don't assume that throwing in the towel is what God wants you to do. It's sad to hear, as you sometimes do, of professing Christians who have walked away from their marriages saying things like, well surely God just wants me to be happy. Or even, God's told me that I ought to get divorced. If you're ever tempted to think those things, please realise it is the world that is telling you that, not God. God has told you to stay married, and realise that God's desire is for your holiness rather than first and foremost your immediate happiness. If you are here and struggling in your marriage now or in the future, can I urge you to seek help, both from the Lord's and from others in the church family. Secondly, very briefly, to those who are not yet married but who would one day like to be, I hope we can see marriage is not something to be entered into lightly. There is a real temptation, I think, given the very high value that our society and actually even often people in the church can place on marriage, to be pressured into marrying, to kind of rush into doing it. When in fact it might not be sensible to do that. It's not something to be entered into lightly. There is God's design for marriage. Jesus insists it is to be a permanent union between a man and a woman. And for most of us here, I think it probably won't surprise us to hear Jesus correcting a liberal view of divorce. So it's important for us to realise then that actually, the heart of this passage, it's not actually what Jesus says to answer the laid-back liberal. In actual fact, it's what he says next to address the moralistic conservative. That's what Jesus goes on to do in verses 7 to 9, where he wants to highlight for us that the reason for broken marriages is a broken world. That's our second point this morning. Look with me again from verse 7. Why then, they asked, did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? Jesus replies, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. The Pharisees in verse 7 are a little confused. If that's the case, they say, if divorce always saddens God, well then why on earth did Moses give us a law about it? Why would God want to regulate something that he's displeased with? To which Jesus replies, well, because of his kindness and forbearance with sinful people. Do you notice the subtle but important change in language between the Pharisees' question and Jesus' reply? So they ask, why did Moses command a man to give a certificate of divorce? Jesus replies, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. Again, it was never God's intention that marriages would split up. But because he knew the sinfulness of his people, he graciously gave instructions for what could happen in cases where sin had already been committed. Jesus says that Moses' concession, not a command, a concession in Deuteronomy 24, as not a reflection of the way that the Creator God has designed marriage, rather it is a reflection of the hardness of human hearts. In other words, why did Deuteronomy 24 need to be written if Genesis 2 said marriage was to be permanent? Well, the answer is that after Genesis 2 comes Genesis 3. It was not this way, says Jesus, from the beginning. But then the fall happened. We rebelled against our Creator God. And immediately you see in Genesis 3, relationships in every sphere of life began to break down and have continued to break down ever since. See, when Jesus is speaking about hard hearts here, he isn't speaking in kind of soppy relationship language of, you know, hearts growing cold, this situation that some couples might find themselves in if they're not careful. Rather, hardness of heart in the Bible is a universal condition that every one of us has, whether we're married or divorced or unmarried. One of my favourite computer games that I used to play when I was growing up was called Theme Hospital. It was a brilliant game, which I wasted many hours playing. The idea was that you built and you managed a hospital which would diagnose and then treat a variety of comical made-up medical conditions. My favourite one was called Bloaty Head Syndrome, where a patient would come in with this massively enlarged head, and a doctor would get a pin and could pop it like a balloon, and then get this kind of air pump and reinflate it to its normal size. A very amusing process to watch, I'm sure you can imagine. I'd be very happy to show you at some point afterwards if you're in any doubts. Lots of other funny made-up medical conditions like that in the game. But Jesus' diagnosis here in verse 8 is that there is a very real spiritual condition that every human being has by nature since Genesis 3. It's called hardness of heart. And Jesus wants us to be clear that hardness of heart really is a universal condition. Again, notice that the deliberate choice of language he uses in verse 8. Notice he doesn't say, because their hearts were hard, Moses allowed them to divorce their wives. He says to the Pharisees, to the respectable moralistic conservatives, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, literally because of your hardness of heart. There's no suggestion here that Jesus knows something about the personal lives of these particular Pharisees that we don't. And yet, just as he has done before in Matthew, again, he tells the moralistic Pharisees here that they themselves are part of the problem with the world. That they have exactly the same hard heart problem, divorced or not, that leads to the breakup of marriages. Do you see, Matthew is using this little episode, this discussion about divorce, not as a way of wagging the finger at society or to shame individuals whose marriages have failed. Rather, he is placing it here at the start of this section of his gospel to give us a window into the heart of humanity. To show us our need, every one of us, for God's grace. So divorce may be the topic of the discussion here, but it is merely one symptom of a universal condition. That's his point. Earlier in the Gospel, we've seen Jesus outline what some of the other symptoms are. Back in chapter 15, he said this, out of the heart of mankind come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, and slander. It's a pretty wide-ranging list, isn't it? You ever had evil thoughts? Well then, like me, Jesus says you too have this condition, hardness of heart. So the primary application of this passage for us must be profound humility and great thanksgiving for the grace that God's given to us through Jesus. You may have noticed that, as happens frequently through Matthew's Gospel, this passage begins in verse 2 with Jesus healing a crowd of people. Just a little reminder to us again that Jesus came to fix a broken world and a broken humanity. He came to heal us most significantly from our hard heart condition and all of the bitter consequences that flow from it. And so very wonderfully, because of his work for us on the cross, he's able to promise those who've trusted in him complete forgiveness, whether our sin is in the area of marriage or any other area of the many ways that we fail God. And he is able to promise us a future one day of a perfect world where we'll never more experience any of the pain and the hurts of the broken relationships and broken families that so many of us do in this one. Clearly then, one thing that we must guard our hearts against is treating or even thinking of those who have been divorced with any sense of moral superiority whatsoever. To do that would be to completely miss the point of what Jesus is teaching here. It may not be quite as true to the same extent nowadays, but it certainly has been the case in the not too distant past in our society that divorced people have been treated almost as kind of second-class citizens. It'd be an awful thing if that was to ever happen in a church. We are all moral failures in need of forgiveness. Must treat one another, therefore, with grace and with love, just as the Lord Jesus himself has done with us. Similarly, I imagine it would be very easy if you're a married person here this morning to look at the divorce statistics in our country at the moment and feel a sense of pride and achievement at having kept your marriage together this long. In which case, I think it's worth bearing in mind that actually the reason that, relatively speaking, a greater proportion of your marriages have lasted is not because of some inherent stickability. Rather, it's through the grace of God at work in your lives and on your hard hearts. In fact, what the statistic seems to suggest is that actually, but for the grace of God, it's likely that about half of you would be divorced. Give great thanks for God's grace to you. We're not going to have time to get on to verses 13 to 15. But as for verses 10 to 12, I have to admit I've spent quite a bit of time scratching my head over them. I don't think it's immediately obvious quite how they fit with the big points of verses 1 to 9, or quite why Matthew felt the need to include this little extra part of the discussion in his account at this point. So you can tell me afterwards over coffee, if you like, what you think about this last point. Maybe you have a better theory for what they're doing here, but this is my current thinking on them. As I've thought about what Jesus goes on to teach over the next couple of chapters, I think what Matthew wants us to recognise here is that there is something greater than marriage to be concerned about, and that is the kingdom of heaven. Marriage is not ultimate. The kingdom of heaven is. Now, I reckon there is some extent to which the disciples have grasped that in their rather extreme response in verse 10. So it was unthought through as it may be. They respond to Jesus, verse 10, if this is the situation between a husband and a wife, it's better not to marry. It's true, I think there is, seems to be at least some element of worldliness in that response, in that the idea of staying faithfully committed to one person in a lifelong relationship seems almost unimaginably hard to them. And yet, at the same time, I reckon the very fact that their conclusion is, well, it would be better not to marry them, does at least show some understanding of the priority of the kingdom of heaven in their minds. So you can check out the cross-references down on the outline on the back afterwards if you like. But actually, both back in chapter 18, and significantly back in chapter 5, in the midst of Jesus' teaching on adultery and divorce in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus told his disciples that if their eye caused them to stumble, it would be better for them to cut it out. Or if their hand caused them to stumble, it would be better for them to cut it off. Such was the importance of entering the kingdom of heaven. And so it seems to me that actually, however misguided their response is, they at least have taken some of that teaching to heart. Saying they'd rather not be married if it risks jeopardizing their place in the kingdom of heaven. And then likewise, in verses 11 to 12, when Jesus kind of semi-affirms what they've said, that it will be better for some people not to marry, although he's not quite saying it, I think, for the same reasons the disciples are thinking of, it seems Jesus has more in mind the benefits of remaining single for the sake of being better able to serve the kingdom, idea the Bible speaks about elsewhere. Nevertheless, I think what he's saying, at least the thrust of what he's saying, is in a similar vein, which again is that marriage isn't ultimate. There is something more important in life than marriage, and that's the kingdom of heaven. And so some of those who understand that, not everyone, but some, says Jesus, may therefore choose to stay single, either for a period of time or for life, for the sake of better serving the kingdom. Now, that is an idea, it must be said, that makes absolutely no sense to the world around us, does it? The idea of remaining celibate voluntarily makes no more sense to our culture today than the idea of becoming a eunuch voluntarily would have made to people back in Jesus' day. And if you're here this morning and wondering just why on earth anybody would, in their right minds, choose to do that, would willingly give up marriage and choose to live a celibate life for the sake of God's kingdom, well, can I encourage you to come back next week? Because next Sunday, as we look at the end of chapter 19 together, we're going to see that sacrificing our lives for the sake of Jesus really is worth it. Marriage is not ultimate. The kingdom of heaven is. And so let's give great thanks that by God's grace, Jesus came to fix the problem of our hard hearts and on the cross to bear the burden of all of the ways in which we've failed to live according to God's design for us, so that we can be part of that kingdom. Let's pray together.